This is the Rational Reminder Podcast, a weekly reality check on sensible investing and financial decision-making for Canadians. We are hosted by me, Benjamin Felix, and Cameron Passmore, portfolio managers at PWL Capital.
Episode 165, and this week we had a really interesting guest. Gordon Erlam joined us. And Gordon is someone that you came across through some of your research.
He came up in the Rational Reminder community a while ago, where there was a conversation going on about bonds and annuities and what the optimal allocations were. And somebody pointed out the best resource on this is this guy named Gordon Erlam, who's done his own sort of self-published papers.
To say the least.
Right. So I started looking into his stuff, and it's very interesting. He takes a very different perspective on how financial planning should be done. One of the things that made me not just interested, but really interested in him, in having him on the podcast, is that not only is he a guy who's done all of this research, but he's actually had two papers published on these topics in financial planning journals that I subscribe to. So I was able to go and read those published papers as well. And that just made him all that much more interesting, because his stuff is not just on the internet, it's been through the peer review process in real journals. So that legitimized, I guess, all of these interesting ideas that he had put forward on his own website. So that made me even more interested. But then you start looking into the other stuff that he's done. He's done tons of interesting thinking on charitable giving from the perspective of where to give, how to give, when to give, and the asset allocation for the money that you're going to use to give. So that's all very interesting. But then on retirement planning, which is where he's done the most writing, and he's built some tools that are available online for people to use, which we can link to in the show notes. That stuff's just fascinating. So we spent a lot of time talking to him about that. But then to top all of that off, his personal story is just fascinating, because he was an early Google employee. He was an entrepreneur before that, had several startups. Many of them failed, as he explains on his own website. But one of them, after he left Google, was acquired by Google for a pretty significant sum of money. We talked to him about that during the episode. So you take all that together, and I mean, there are not that many people that are they have this many unique and interesting things to say on so many topics.
And he's lived all his own research, which is so interesting. He does a charitable, which he's very passionate about. He's retired. It is really good. Really interesting. Interesting guy.
Yeah. So I think it's a worthwhile listen for sure. And we'll link to a bunch of Gordon's research as well, which is similarly worthwhile to take a read through.
Cool. All right. Here's Gordon Erlam.
Gordon Erlam, welcome to the Rational Reminder Podcast.
Thank you.
So Gordon, you worked at Google prior to Google's IPO, and given your clearly data-driven approach, just that I've started to understand from doing research for this interview, I've got to ask, what did you do with your Google equity after the IPO?
I followed the recommendations of financial planners, which was to diversify and sell all my equity as soon as it vested. It makes a lot of sense, but there's also a lot of heartache associated with that, in that if I had held on to that equity of my employer, it would be worth, I don't know, $10 or $20 million today.
Wow. So looking back, how do you feel about the decision?
I have mixed feelings, obviously. I mean, I still feel I did the right rational thing. I mean, back when no one knew what Google was going to become, it could have been the next Yahoo. And so I'm comfortable with that decision, but it's like a lot of decisions in finance where it's easy to look back and say, this is what you should have done, but it's very hard to know what you should do at the moment.
So if you met someone today who currently is in a similar situation to what you were back then, instead of getting advice from a financial planner, what would your advice be to them?
I'd still say you should sell your equity. You don't want an over-concentration in your employer's funds.
That's definitely the rational answer, and we would tend to agree. Now, your story just gets more and more interesting. After you left Google and you left some equity on the table, then they actually ended up acquiring a company that you had started prior to joining them for a pretty significant sum. It was for $625 million cash, as I understand it. Did the windfall from that transaction change your life in any ways that you did not expect it to?
it didn't change it a whole lot. It made things more comfortable and secure outside. I previously had enough funds that I was able to fund most of my lifestyle, but now instead of having to worry about the stock market on a day-to-day basis, I could feel very confident and secure.
I'm curious if anything that you expected to change actually stayed the same after that event.
I'm not sure it did. I'd say, however, one thing that it would be nice if it changed that didn't is this sense of when I was young, I had so many opportunities before me, and now I'm at my current age, I've got a limited number of opportunities and I've got to be careful about choosing between them. I can say as I get older, I'll only have one or two opportunities left that I can really pursue full time. And so it would be nice if becoming wealthy could reduce the risks of that and give you more time in which to live. But all the wealth in the world won't change how much time we've got on this planet.
That's a really interesting point. One of the things that you've done a lot of writing and clearly thinking about is giving back. After the Postini transaction, where you sold the company you'd started, you were able to start a foundation with some of those proceeds. And the mission of the foundation on its website, which I love the careful choice of language, seeks to do the greatest expected good. And so it's taking inspiration from the effective altruism movement. Can you describe what effective altruism is and how you're implementing it through your foundation?
Okay. Effective altruism's just the idea that in our lives we should seek to do the greatest good we can. But it hasn't received that much attention in the historical past. Foundations were set up just and then they're allowed to do whatever they feel like rather than any. Like in the financial world, there's a huge focus on trying to make as much profit as you can, and every company is focused on that. But in the charitable world, there isn't the same focus on what are the returns you get from the investments you make. So effective altruism is a movement that started in the last maybe 15 or 20 years, trying to figure out what are the returns you get. So an example would be something like bed nets for treating malaria. And traditionally, foundations might have gone in and distribute bed nets and feel good about doing that. But the effective altruist will say, how much does a bed net cost? What's the chance that that distribution of a bed net will prevent one case of malaria? Even put a value on the value of a human life. From that, calculate for each dollar you spend on bed nets, you get like $10 of social return or whatever the number might be. And so that's what the effective altruism movement seeks to do, is compare these different charitable causes to figure out which are the most effective ones.
That's so interesting. People watching this on YouTube can see, I'm just thinking, there's so many questions that come to mind because so many people are passionate about certain charities based on perhaps our personal family experience. But it sounds like, and I find this whole idea very appealing, it sounds like you're suggesting that people should focus more on the, I guess, the efficacy of the endeavor as opposed to the almost spiritual motivation behind it. Is that true?
Yes, it is. And for effective altruism movements, tended to identify, there's a number of cause areas that seem to have the biggest impact. One of them is global health, because very cheaply you can do something like vaccinate or provide bed nets and save lives. Another big area is animal welfare. And then a third area is the effect of the future artificial intelligence and global catastrophic risks and trying to minimize those.
Based on your evaluation, and you've got another website just for people that are listening called Back of the Envelope, where you go through your calculations to figure out which causes have the most impact or the most expected impact. Can you talk about, you just mentioned three there, can you talk about which one has the greatest expected benefit?
It's interesting, with the back of the envelope guide to philanthropy that I created, there's some areas like global health that do seem to have a very high definite benefit. But there's other areas like the risks of artificial intelligence on the future that probably have a higher expected benefit, but there's much more uncertainty regarding what the actual value is.
Interesting. Well, one of the other things on this topic that you've written about very, very well, and I really appreciated your thoughts, is on asset allocation for foundations or for donor-advised funds. Do you think if someone has set up a foundation or if they've stuck money into a donor-advised fund, should they be thinking about asset allocation for their giving money in a way that is different from their personal consumption money?
I think the risks go down. There isn't as much concern you need to take about risk, so you can invest more aggressively. But the way I do it is I treat my personal assets and the money I've got set aside for going to charitable causes as one big bucket, and try to optimize the overall outcome of that large bucket. And then only at the end, when I get a spending recommendation, factor back and say how much of it should come out of the actual donor-advised fund or charitable foundation versus how much of it is personal expenditures.
Can you expand on why people can take more risk with the foundation money than they can with the personal consumption money?
It has to do with if the foundation loses money, there isn't as much harm to the like social good or whatever it is you're trying to achieve with that money as with your personal funds. An example of this might be like the sensitivity of investors is higher to the stock market. Like the stock market goes down by a factor of two and then their wealth's gone down by a factor of two. But the stock market doesn't have as much impact on the wealth of someone living in Africa on $2 a day.
Okay, that's fascinating. So your consumption varies, is more sensitive to changes in the stock market, but because each dollar is worth more to somebody who you may be doing social good to by donating, the sensitivity is not as high to changes in the stock market.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. They've got other resources besides the stock market that are keeping them alive, so they're less concerned about a drop in the value of the stock market and your charitable investment in them.
Wow.
Fascinating.
That is really interesting thinking. Is it possible to optimize the timing of spending from a foundation?
Well, in theory, the answer is yes. It's very easy. You just plug in the numbers and run some calculations and you'll get an answer. But that answer depends hugely on what I'd call the charitable discount rate, which is whether $1 spent today can do more or less good than a dollar spent in the future. And unfortunately, it's very hard to pin down the charitable discount rate, which makes it very difficult to know, should you try and spend all your money today because you think by spending it today, that will allow the recipients of money to grow their wealth, or should you hold on to it and defer spending into the future?
That is really interesting.
How do you determine the charitable discount rate?
It's an unknown. I don't have any good answers. I've plugged in my best estimates, and unfortunately, they're all over the map. They're not precise enough to give you an answer to your original question, which was, how do you time the spending from a foundation?
I want to touch on just on the asset allocation for foundations again. If the sensitivity of those assets to changes in the stock market is less than our personal consumption assets, does it follow that you would want to be much more aggressive in your foundation money?
Yes.
To what extent? Like, are we talking about using leverage? Are we talking about small cap value tilts inside the endowment money?
Certainly a small cap value tilt, but I think it then gets into regulatory issues of, if you want to get more aggressive in a foundation, there's issues of like the regulators saying you're taking too much risk. And that I don't have a good understanding of the exact regulatory environment, but something I've heard is a concern of when you are running a foundation or that, of how much risk you can take.
Interesting. So would it be safe to summarize as, theoretically, if you have a foundation or a donor-advised fund where you've got this money that's for altruistic purposes, you want to take as much risk, as much compensated risk as possible within the confines of whatever regulatory or otherwise? Is that the sensible way to think about it?
I think that's close to the truth. I'm not sure. I think there does have to be an upper bound, but that upper bound is certainly higher than for your personal consumption.
Okay. Yeah, it's fascinating to think about. It really is.
So maybe we can just shift to some questions on retirement planning. I'm curious if you can describe some of the big differences between, say, the typical practitioner approach to financial planning and the economist's approach to financial planning.
Okay. So I think practitioners typically tend to focus on like growing wealth and focus on how much assets you have and putting a dollar value on what your net worth is. Whereas the economist is more concerned of what good is having that wealth? What are you going to do with it? And that is spend it and consume it. So economists are more concerned with utility of consumption. Utility just means how much good you can do or achieve for each dollar of spending. As you spend more each year, the utility doesn't increase linearly, but it starts to saturate. So an example of this is if I'm spending or consuming $100,000 a year, and then suddenly my consumption jumps to $200,000 a year, then my utility that I receive from that consumption isn't going to double. It might be, say, 1.5 times as much just because I don't get the same value from money. And so that rate at which consumption tends to flatten is what economists call risk aversion or relative risk aversion.
Yeah, that's definitely different from just using something like a fixed withdrawal rate if we start getting into the utility of consumption. Can you describe one of the things you've written quite a bit about and built some models for to capture the economist view of financial planning is stochastic dynamic programming. Can you describe what that is and how it can be used to solve for the optimal asset allocation and consumption using these economic models?
Okay, stochastic dynamic programming is based on the idea that if you knew, for example, you were going to live to age 100, you could figure out what the optimal thing to do at age 100 is, which is you spend all your money. So then you'd step back to age 99 and say, knowing what I'm going to do at age 100, if I've got, say, $200,000, what would I do at age 99, given the different possible returns I might get? And you'll look at all the different returns and the knowledge of what you do at age 100, and you'll work out what the optimal thing to do at age 99 is, given that stochastic uncertainty in the returns. And then you can keep stepping back to age 98 and 97, and each year compute what to do based on what you know you do in future years. So that, in a nutshell, is stochastic dynamic programming.
So how is that better than, say, the typical approaches to financial planning? Like, what does it mean to the listener here that may have done a typical financial plan?
I think the difference is it's based on utility of consumption. So it gives you results in terms of how much to expect to consume, and it tells you how your consumption should change over time in response to changes in the market.
Interesting. Keeping in mind the marginal utility of consumption, where you're much worse off if it drops below a certain point, and you're not much better off if it goes above a certain point. Yeah, that is very interesting. And you've done a lot of work on this, and you've even built a tool that people can find online, A-Calc, which uses stochastic dynamic programming to give people results that they can use. It is using U.S. taxes, I believe, though. So for our Canadian listeners, just a note of caution if you do check out the tool. You've since then, though, moved on to reinforcement learning as opposed to using stochastic dynamic programming. Can you describe what that is and why you've decided that it is better than stochastic dynamic programming?
Reinforcement learning is a machine learning technique that, unlike stochastic dynamic programming, which will give you the precise mathematical optimal solution, reinforcement learning learns by just doing millions and millions of simulated years and trying different things and seeing what gives the better results. And so gradually pushing this model of how you should behave closer and closer to the actual optimal value, but it never gives a precise optimum. But the reason for switching from stochastic dynamic programming that does have a precise solution and a precise optimum to reinforcement learning is reinforcement learning is able to handle a lot of real-world complicating factors that stochastic dynamic programming can't. So anywhere where you have like a state variable, it gets very expensive to use stochastic dynamic programming. So an example of that state would be the cost basis of your investments or the value of a spear in addition to the value of your portfolio. And so there's a lot of those things. And then the other issue is stochastic dynamic programming. You have to almost run things backwards in time. It's which doesn't sound difficult, but it's a lot easier if you can run a model forwards in time and optimize that.
So did any of your beliefs or assumptions around financial planning change when you went through this reinforcement learning exercise?
I think it solidified some of the beliefs or suspicions I had. One of those has to do with the value of long-duration inflation index bonds, which to a traditional financial planner, they seem dangerous because the long duration means they're very volatile. But to the economist's perspective is you're like buying your retirement consumption and locking it in, even though it might change in nominal terms. If you've bought a 30-year inflation index bond, it's know what that's going to give you for your retirement consumption.
Generally speaking, how would you say that the near optimal, because as you said, it doesn't quite get to the optimal results, but the near optimal generated results of the reinforcement learning process, how do they compare to things like the, I don't know, the 4% rule or other typical retirement planning rules of thumb?
I did some analysis of it and I found that in every scenario I considered, reinforcement learning outperformed the rules of thumb. And it did that from anywhere from 6 to 32%. That was after I had carefully tuned those rules of thumb, because they'll have like different parameters of how long you should assume you're going to live and what the stock bond asset allocation is. So in each of those rules of thumb, I tune them to find the optimal value, which is a laborious process. And then reinforcement learning was able to beat them straight off the bat.
When we say beat, so say by, it beats it by 32%, is that measuring it in terms of consumption or utility? What is it measuring?
Something called certainty equivalent consumption. And the certainty equivalent is the constant consumption that would have the same value to you as an uncertain variable consumption that you might be expected to experience.
Wow. Can you talk through just to anchor on the 4% rule as an example, in that case, you're spending 4% adjusted for inflation of the starting value of the portfolio every year. If someone's using reinforcement learning for their retirement plan, what is their path going to look like? Like, are they spending a different amount every year?
Yes, you'll be spending a different amount every year, and your asset allocation will be varying from 1 year to the next. Not by huge amounts, but by somewhat significant amounts.
How prevalent are annuities in the optimal model?
Annuities make quite a significant improvement. That is SPIAs, single premium immediate annuities.
And is there a certain timing when annuities become more appealing?
I've done some work on this outside of the asset allocation models I've been evaluating. And annuities are very similar to bonds, and that they provide a fixed payment each year. So based on that, you'd think you could substitute annuities for part of your bond portfolio. But there's a pricing discrepancy with annuities that makes it more advantageous to delay the purchase until later in life. That pricing discrepancy has to do with the mortality tables that annuity providers use. They lump everyone who's purchased an annuity into the same bucket. So at age 80, their mortality is based on people who bought an annuity 20 years ago and might not now be in such good health, and people who bought an annuity just last year and so are in good health. And so because of that, you can actually do better by delaying your purchase of annuities.
Is there a, I don't want to use the word rule of thumb here, but I'm going to use it. Is there a rule of thumb in terms of the age, or maybe in your results, what is the typical age where the annuities do start to make the most sense?
I'd say from 70 to 80, but this comes back to what I was saying before about reinforcement learning only offering an approximate solution. It doesn't give you the precise sense, so it's a bit fuzzy. The nice thing about reinforcement learning is if something's significantly going to improve your welfare, it will tell you. But when things are less clear, you get a fuzzy and uncertain answer, and you can train the model once and get one recommendation, and then you train it a second time and you get a different recommendation. So unfortunately, the precise timing of annuities is one of those things of it probably doesn't make a lot of difference, and the recommendations you'll get out of using reinforcement learning are a bit different every time you run it.
That's fascinating, which is probably a closer reflection of reality. If someone were to give a point estimate of this is the exact optimal age, it's unlikely to be accurate anyway. When we're talking about reinforcement learning, something just popped into my head when you're speaking there. What are the big assumptions that are going into this model? Like, are we having to define expected returns and life expectancy? Like, what are the inputs that are going to change most materially the outputs?
Yes, you have to estimate both of those things. So for like life expectancy is an important and I think under-discussed issue in retirement planning. So life expectancy, I have a stochastic model which is based on the Social Security cohort life tables, but then I let people apply to that their own adjustment based on how healthy they actually feel they are.
So Ben mentioned the 4% rule earlier. Is constant spending ever the optimal solution?
I don't believe so. I mean, constant spending is trying to apply a fixed constant model to a dynamic varying situation. And so the consequences are probably not going to end up very well. If we had a constant stock market, then a constant spending rule would make sense, but we don't.
I'm going to ask the inverse of the question, and maybe the answer is obvious based on what you just said, but is variable spending always what people should be aiming to do if they want to have an optimal retirement spending path?
Up to a point, variable spending makes sense. But at some age, you get so old that you should probably put all your money into SPIAs. And so at that point, you'd have constant consumption.
How do you practically recommend people that are entering retirement think about their spending? Like, do you think that they're best to really itemize their spending and find out what that basic need is every month? And then the discretionary, be it travel, vehicles, luxury items, maybe that excess amount that would be the variable part of their spending? Like, do you have any practical advice for people?
I know I do keep track of my spending based on categories and refer to that. I don't know what you'd do if you didn't keep track of your spending. I guess you can look at bank statements and get a sense of what you're spending each year.
But how much in percentage terms might your spending vary year to year? Is it significant?
For me, it is, just because probably the bulk of my spending goes to charitable causes. So there isn't that same sensitivity to variations in spending. It comes back to being able to take more risk on the charitable side of things and let that follow the stock market more than personal spending.
So your personal spending is relatively steady, stable, whereas if you have a good year in your portfolio, your charitable donations may be larger.
Wow. Is the variation in spending on the giving side dictated more so by the stock market or by the charitable discount rate that you talked about earlier?
More by the stock market, the charitable discount rates. So imprecise, it doesn't give a good prediction as to what to do. So what I did is I set the charitable discount rate to a value that will let me spend the charitable assets over my lifetime and be done with it.
Interesting. And then your variable giving, is it dictated by the same reinforcement learning model that your consumption would be?
Yes.
Okay, fascinating. Now, you mentioned a couple of things earlier that I want to come back to. We've talked about variable spending. We've talked about variable asset allocation, which, as some people may recognize, as tactical asset allocation. I didn't mention you have another tool, AI Planner, which again, people can use on the website, on its website. We can link to it in our show notes. And that's a reinforcement learning financial planning tool that you've created online, which is very, very cool. It has the option to turn off and on tactical asset allocation. Now, I want to ask, and you have a note on the website saying that in a tactical case, it gives you a slightly better outcome than the not tactical or strategic asset allocation or planning case. For tactical to be slightly optimal, how important is mean reversion in stock returns?
Mean reversion is one of the two big factors that go into the tactical planning. So the other factor is looking at the stock market volatility and taking advantage of when it's more volatile, you want to hold less stocks and vice versa.
So it's both mean reversion and volatility clustering that are dictating the tactical allocations?
Yes.
Interesting. How, and I'm asking because this is something that we've spent a lot of time digging into recently. I agree, volatility clustering is a thing. There's no question there. That one's fairly obvious. How confident are you in mean reversion in stock returns?
I've done some analysis of it myself, and I'm not at all confident that it exists. But if I take a view of it might or might not exist, then what level of mean reversion would you expect? I come out to something like for every 10% the stock market's overvalued, there's a 1% just decline in returns going forward. So it's a bit like if you've got a bunch of numbers and they add up to 0.5 and you're trying to work out is the average equal to zero at the 95% confidence level. You might not be sure of that. It might be a borderline call. But if you're going to do some working mathematics based on the average, you're going to take the best estimate is 0.5.
On the volatility clustering, we're talking about tactical planning changes, so in consumption and in asset allocation. But volatility clustering is a pretty short-term phenomenon. So how, practically speaking, if someone's using the reinforcement learning model to adjust their spending and asset allocation, what would be the trigger, I guess, is the question. Would you do it when markets are volatile? You change your asset allocation?
That's what it recommends. And this is doing asset allocation on a once-a-year basis. So you probably don't get the full advantage of volatility targeting. But you'd probably get some of the benefits. And this is sort of ignoring a lot of the tax considerations and complications that would come from moving your portfolio around that much, that frequently.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the, from our perspective, definitely one of the big deterrents of doing more tactical stuff is transaction costs and taxes. And especially if we say turn off mean reversion in the model, then it, I think, probably gets even less compelling.
So given all this work and all that you've learned in this area of personal financial planning and research, what's the key message or two that you'd want to get across to someone who may be using traditional planning approaches?
One of the messages has to do with the value of long duration inflation index funds. Then probably another important message is you can't do any of its planning for economic planning without knowing about pensions and social security and other forms of fixed guaranteed income. And so that makes a huge difference to things like asset allocation and consumption. And so I think that needs to be emphasized more in plans. It's meaningless to talk about what an asset allocation should be for, say, a 65-year-old without knowing, do they have $100,000 of pension income a year or not?
And if I was to sit you down with my 22-year-old son, what would be your main piece of advice to him?
I think for him, it's focus on saving. And I think your saving rate is more important than your asset allocation or some of these other things we talk about.
Yeah, I've seen some, there's been some interesting, I don't know if I've seen academic papers on that, but definitely some interesting blog posts showing the relative importance of saving versus asset allocation. So that's a very good point. I want to come back on the long-dated inflation-protected bonds for a minute, because that is one that's the second thing that you said there, basically taking a holistic approach. 100% agree. And that's something that we do as well. But the long-dated inflation-protected bonds is not something that we've looked at really for clients in our financial planning practice. Can you talk a little bit more practically speaking about how that looks? Is that similar to annuities where they're being purchased later in life?
Not necessarily. I think with inflation index bonds, you can purchase them early in life. And that's what I've done with my personal portfolio, is it's a mixture of stocks and long duration inflation index bonds.
Fascinating. And again, on that same topic, is that something that you would be tactically allocating to based on the reinforcement learning model?
Yes, it is.
Huh. Yeah, okay. Very interesting. You had a paper in 2020 in the Journal of Retirement on reinforcement learning and why you have transitioned to using it. So covering a lot of the points we've talked about in our conversation so far. And you mentioned in that paper that this is the first new approach to the portfolio problem in over 50 years, which is a very interesting comment. Do you have any sense for what might be next? What's the next big innovation in the portfolio problem going to be?
I think there's two areas. One has to do with right now, you really require a lot of computing resources to solve using reinforcement learning. And so what I do on AI Planner is I compute a generic model, and then I try and force each individual into that generically trained model and give the results from that. As computers get faster and faster, I think it will become possible to train reinforcement learning to each individual's scenario. And so that would be one big improvement. And the second area is, I think, there probably needs to be some understanding, some theoretical understanding of the relationship between stochastic dynamic programming and reinforcement learning, and what are the links and relationship there, because we're both trying to solve Markov decision processes. And so there's some commonality that might be fruitful for both areas would come from that better theoretical understanding.
Fascinating. When you talk about training the machine learning process for a situation and that being an expensive process, what does that look like? Like, how expensive are we talking?
We're talking about, for AI Planner, I train for 200 million years. Then I train 10 models for 200 million years and take an average of them. So that's 2 billion simulated years of financial.
Wow. Okay. Okay, because we often run 500 trials of our Monte Carlo simulations. So that's a little, a few more trials. Wow. I wasn't expecting the number to be that large.
Amazing. Before we get to our last question, Ben, any others for Gordon?
No, I mean, Gordon, your body of work is just fascinating and you take a very different approach to thinking through all this stuff. So your perspectives are very much appreciated.
Which leads us to our final question, Gordon. How do you define success in your life? You've had an incredible life and career and research and philanthropy. I'm really curious, how do you define success?
I think for me, I define success as having sufficient resources to be able to work on the problems that are both interesting and important.
Beautiful answer. This has been a real pleasure to get a chance to meet you and introduce you to our listeners. Gordon, thanks so much.
Thank you.